the two hypothermic men. Both Dahlgren and Jordina barely kept from flying out of the boat as it jarred to an immediate halt. Jordina quickly stood up, brushed some snow off his head and shoulders, then smiled at Case, who stared back through listless eyes. "Just 5 minutes to some hot chicken soup, my friends," Jordina said, grabbing Quinlan like a rag doll and laying him between two bench seats. He then took Case's arm and helped the lethargic man crawl into the Zodiac. Dahlgren retrieved a pair of dry blankets from a storage locker and quickly covered both men. "Can you reach the other one?" Dahlgren asked. Jordina gazed at the rocking mound of snow that rose 6 feet over his head. "Yes, but keep the engine running. I think this ice cube is on its last legs." Stepping off the inflatable, he kicked a toehold into the hardened snow and began to climb. With each step, he'd punch his fist into the crust for a hand grip and later foothold as he climbed higher. The iceberg rocked and swayed in the rolling swells, and several times he thought he might go flying off into the water. Ascending as quickly as he could, he popped his head over the top of the ridge, finding Bew spread out on the crest with his face down. Yanking Bew's torso, Jordino pulled the limp body closer until he could slide him over his shoulder. Clamping an arm around the frozen man's legs, he began the unsteady descent down the face of the berg. Yet for all Bew's dead weight, Jordino might have been carrying a sack of potatoes. The powerful Italian wasted no time, quickly descending several steps, then kicking off the snow wall and dropping the last several feet into the Zodiac's rubber hull. Laying Bew down beside the other men, Jordino jumped back out and heaved his body against the bow of the Zodiac. Digging his short, powerful legs into the snow, he shoved the boat off the iceberg, hopping aboard as Dahlgren goosed the outboard motor into reverse. Dahlgren had barely turned and made headway when a huge swell rolled up in front of them. Jordino reached over and pinned the prone men to the deck as the wave crashed into the bow. Icy foam sprayed everywhere as the Zodiac's bow shot skyward until the small boat stood nearly vertical. Then the big wave rolled through and away, sending the inflatable crashing into the following trough. Dahlgren steered directly into a second large wave, riding it through with slightly less violence. As the Zodiac shook off the effects of the second swell, Dahlgren and Jordino glanced back as the two waves pummeled the iceberg. Watching with morbid fascination, they saw the first wave pitch the towering chunk of ice nearly onto its side. Before the berg could right itself, the second wave struck, completely obliterating the iceberg. As the wave rolled past, a few large chunks of ice slowly popped to the surface. Had they not arrived when they did, Bew, Case, and Quinlan would have been washed into the frigid sea by the twin waves and perished within minutes. Chapter 30. The three Canadians, all suffering various degrees of hypothermia, were able to cling to life until the wave-tossed Zodiac was clutched from the sea and dropped onto the deck of the Narwhal. Dahlgren had been fortunate to locate the research ship in just a few minutes. The storm had obliterated any satellite signals, rendering the GPS unit useless. He instead took a reverse compass heading and motored toward the general position of the ship. The large intervening ice floe had drifted past, allowing an unencumbered route through the high seas. Jordino detected the wail of the ship's air horn firing a stout blast, and the brightly lit narwhal appeared through the swirling winds a short time later. A heavily bundled Rudy gun was standing by when the Zodiac hit the deck, and he promptly directed the transfer of the injured men to the medical bay. Bew and Case were revived before long, but Quinlan remained unconscious for several hours as the ship's doctor worked feverishly to raise the man's core body temperature. Twice Quinlan's heart stopped beating, and twice he was frantically resuscitated, until his body temperature gradually approached 98 degrees and his blood pressure stabilized. After shaking the ice off their garments, Jordino and Dahlgren changed into dry clothes and met Gunn on the bridge.
"Do we know if there are any other potential survivors out there?"
Gunn asked the two weary men. Dahlgren shook his head.
"I asked the conscious fellow the same question. He told me there were two other men in the ice camp with them, but that he is certain they were both killed when the ship tore through the camp."
"A ship?"
Not just any ship. Dahlgren nodded grimly. An American Navy warship. Came blasting through the ice and obliterated the entire facility.
That's impossible, Gunn replied.
I'm just telling you what the man said.
Gunn fell silent, his eyes bulging in disbelief.
We'll search some more all the same, he finally said in a low voice.
Then, turning a sympathetic eye toward both men, he added,
That was a heroic rescue effort under terrible conditions. I wouldn't have wanted to trade places with those guys, Jordina remarked. But Dahlgren, a hero? That will be the day, he added with a laugh.
I've a good mind not to share my bottle of Jack Daniels with you for that remark, Dahlgren retorted. Jordino put an arm around the Texan and escorted him off the bridge.
Just one shot, my friend, and I'll see that the Yukon is yours for the taking.
The Narwhal searched the surrounding seas for the next 2 hours, finding only the battered remnants of a blue awning among the ice-infested waters. Gunn reluctantly called off the search when most of the broken floe fragments finally drifted clear of the ice shelf.
Prudhoe Bay would have better facilities, but Tuktoyaktuk is the closer port by about 50 miles.
They do have an airfield, Stenseth said, eyeing a chart of the North American coastline.
We'll have more of a following sea sailing to the latter, Gunn replied, looking over the captain's shoulder. It would probably be best to get them ashore as soon as possible.
Tuktoyaktuk it is.
The town was along a sparse stretch of northern Canadian shoreline, just east of the Alaskan border. The area was well north of the Arctic Circle and beyond the northern tree line as well, a rolling, rocky land covered in snow most of the year. The narwhal plowed through rough waters for 14 hours as the spring storm finally blew itself out. The Beaufort Sea still heaved with high breakers when the Numa ship edged into the protected waters of Kogmalet Bay, aside the town of Tuktoyaktuk. A Canadian Mountie patrol boat guided the ship to the city's industrial pier, where an empty dockside berth awaited. Within minutes, the injured scientists were loaded into a pair of vans and whisked to the local medical center. A thorough checkup deemed the men stable enough for further travel, after which they were loaded onto a plane to Yellowknife. It wasn't until the next day, when the trio arrived in Calgary on a government jet, that their ordeal became headline news. A media circus ensued, as every major newspaper and television network jumped on the story. Bew's eyewitness account of an American warship battering the ice camp and leaving its inhabitants to die struck an angry chord with many Canadians, weary of their southern neighbors' worldly might. Fervor within the Canadian government peaked at an even higher pitch. Already stung by the embarrassing incident involving the mystery ship Atlanta, Coast Guard and military officials within the government showed particular wrath. The nationalistic Prime Minister, his popularity waning, quickly pounced on the incident for political gain. The rescued scientists, Bew, Case, and Quinlan, were feted as guests at the Prime Minister's residence on Sussex Drive in Ottawa, then trotted before the television cameras to once more describe the destruction of the ice camp at the hands of the Americans. With a calculated show of anger, the Prime Minister went so far as to denounce the incident as a barbaric act of war. "Canadian sovereignty will no longer be violated by foreign transgressions," he shrieked to the cameras. With an angry Parliament buttressing his rhetoric, he ordered additional naval forces to the Arctic, while threatening to close the border and shut off oil and gas exports. "The great nation of Canada shall not be bullied. If protection of our sovereignty entails war, then so be it," he cried, his face turning beet red. Overnight, the Prime Minister's popularity soared in the polls. Witnessing the public reaction, his fellow politicians clamored before the media to strike anti-American prose. The story of the ice camp survivors took on a life of its own, propelled by a manipulated media and a self-serving national leader. It became a glory-filled tale of victimization and heroic survival. Yet somehow lost in every retelling of the tragedy was the role of the Numa research crew and their daring rescue effort that had saved the three survivors. Chapter 31 "Jim, do you have a moment?" Walking down a corridor of the White House West Wing, Vice President James Sandecker turned to find the Canadian ambassador calling him from behind. A distinguished-looking man with bushy silver eyebrows, Ambassador John Davis approached with a taciturn look on his face.
"Good morning, John," Sandecker greeted. "What brings you to this neck of the woods so early in the day?"
"Good to see you, Jim," Davis replied, his face brightening a bit. "I'm afraid I was sent to hammer on your good president over my country's agitation with this business in the Northwest Passage."
"I'm headed to a meeting with the president on that very topic. A sad tragedy about the ice camp, but I've been told we had no warships anywhere near there."
"A sticky matter, nevertheless. The hardliners in our government are blowing it full out of proportion." He lowered his tone to a whisper. "Even the Prime Minister is rattling his saber over the matter, though I know he's doing it strictly for political gain. I just fear a foolish escalation of some sort that will lead to further tragedy."
A somber look in the ambassador's gray eyes told Sandecker that his fear was deep-rooted.
"Don't worry, John. Cooler heads will prevail. We've got too much at stake to let something like this degenerate."
Davis nodded his head weakly.
"I sure hope you were right.
Say, Jim, I'd like to express our thanks to your Numa ship and crew. It has been overlooked in the press, but they made a remarkable rescue."
"I'll pass that along. Give my best to Maggie, and let's plan on going sailing again soon."
"I'd like that. Take care, Jim."
A White House aide pressed Sandecker onto the Oval Office, guiding him through the northwest entrance. Seated around a coffee table, Sandecker recognized the president's chief of staff, his national security advisor, and the secretary of defense. The president stood at a side cubby, pouring himself a cup of coffee from an antique silver pot.
"Can I get you a cup, Jim?" Ward asked. The president still had dark circles under his eyes, but appeared more energized than on Sandecker's last visit.
"Sure, Garner. Make it black."
The other administration officials looked aghast at Sandecker for calling the president by his first name, but he didn't care, and neither did Ward. The president handed Sandecker his coffee, then sat down in a gold wingback chair.
"You missed all the fireworks, Jim," the president said. "The Canadian ambassador just gave me holy blazes about those two incidents in the Arctic."
Sandecker nodded.
"I just passed him in the hall. They seem to be taking it quite seriously."
"The Canadians are upset about our proposed plan to divert fresh water from the Great Lakes to replenish the Midwest farming aquifers," said Chief of Staff Meade. "Plus, it is no secret that the Prime Minister's poll numbers are weighed down ahead of a call for parliamentary elections this fall. We have reason to believe there is also an effort to keep our petroleum companies out of the Canadian Arctic," added the National Security Advisor, a short-haired blonde woman named Moss. "The Canadians have been very protective about their Arctic oil and gas resources, which continue to grow in significance."
"Given our current situation, it is hardly an opportune time for them to turn their backs on us," said Meade. "You mean it's not an opportune time for us," noted Sandecker. "You have a point, Jim," the president replied. "The Canadians certainly have a few strong cards in their hand at the moment."
"Which they are already starting to play," said Moss. "The ambassador gave notice that Prime Minister Barrett intends to announce a full prohibition on U.S.-flagged vessels crossing into Canadian Arctic seaways. Any violation will be deemed a trespass on territorial waters and subject to military reprisal."
"The Prime Minister is not one for subtlety," the president remarked. "He went so far as to have the ambassador drop the hint that reductions in oil, natural gas, and hydroelectric power exports to the U.S. are on the table," Meade said, speaking to Sandecker. "That is playing hardball," Sandecker said. "We currently obtain 90% of our natural gas imports from Canada alone. And I know you were counting on the new infusion from Melville Sound to solve our immediate energy problems," he added, addressing the president.
"We can't afford to jeopardize those gas imports," the president said. "They are critical to overcoming this oil crisis and stabilizing the economy."
The Prime Minister's actions boost the Canadian sovereignty rhetoric he's been touting recently to reverse his waning popularity, noted Moss. He seized on the commercial possibilities of an ice-free Northwest Passage some years ago and has strongly argued Canada's ownership claims. It fits in nicely to his newfound appeal to the country's traditionalists.
There's a good deal of power to be had in those Arctic resources, Mead noted.
The Russians are clamoring over the same thing, Sandecker said. The UN Law of the Sea Treaty opened the door for additional Arctic empire building based on the undersea extensions of existing territorial claims. We, in fact, have joined the same subsurface land rush as the Canadians, Russians, Danes, and Norwegians.
That is true, Moss replied, but our potential claims don't really impose much into Canadian waters. It's the passage that is creating all the hysteria. Perhaps because it is the key to accessing and transporting all those Arctic resources.
It seems to me that the Canadians have a pretty sound legal basis for calling the passage part of their internal waters, the president said. The Secretary of Defense bristled. An ex-Navy man like Sandecker, he had managed one of the major oil companies before returning to public service.
Mr. President, he said in a deep voice, it has always been the position of the U.S. that the Northwest Passage constitutes an international strait. The Law of the Sea Convention, I might add, also calls for the right of transit passage through waterways deemed international straits.
Assuming we are on friendly terms with Canada, why do we care if they claim the strait as territorial waters? Asked the president.
Doing so would undermine the precedents already set in the Strait of Malacca, Gibraltar, and Bab el-Mandeb in the Red Sea, Moss recited. Those waterways are open to commercial ships of all nations, not to mention free passage by our own navy ships.
Not to mention the Bosporus and Dardanelles, Sandecker added.
Indeed, replied Moss. If we were to treat the Northwest Passage in a different light, that could offer legal encouragement for the Malaysians to direct traffic through the Malacca, for example. It's just too risky a proposition.
Don't forget our submarine fleet, Sandecker added. We can't very well walk away from the Arctic area of operations.
Jim's absolutely right, said the Secretary of Defense. We're still playing tag with the occasional Russian Delta up there, and now we have the Chinese fleet to worry about. They've just tested a new class of sub-launched ballistic missile with a range of 5,000 miles. It only makes sense that they'll follow the tack of the Russians by hiding their subs under the ice in order to preserve a first launch capability. Mr. President, the Arctic will remain a critical mission area for purposes of our national defense. We can't afford to be shut out of the seaways that are within spitting distance of our own borders.
The president quietly strolled over to the east window and gazed out at the Rose Garden.
I suppose there is no walking away. But there is also no need to fan the flames of distrust. Let's voluntarily abide by the ban for 90 days. I want no American-flagged vessels, including submarines, even to encroach on Canadian Arctic waters during that period. That should give everyone time to cool their heels. Then I'll have State work up a meeting with Prime Minister Barrett, and we'll try to reintroduce some sanity back into the equation.
An excellent suggestion, Meade demurred.
I'll put a call into the Secretary of State right away.
Mr. President, there is one other thing, the Secretary of Defense stated.
I'd like to war plan a few counterstrike scenarios, should events dictate.
Good God, the President thundered. We're talking about Canada here.
The room fell silent while Garner glared at the Secretary of Defense.
Do what you have to. If I know you, you probably already have a full-blown invasion plan all worked out.
The Secretary of Defense sat stone-faced, unwilling to deny the President's accusation.
Seems to me we should be focusing our resources on investigating who's roughing up the Canadians and why, injected Sandecker. What exactly do we know about the two incidents in question?
Very little, I'm afraid, since they both occurred in remote areas, replied Moss. The first incident involved a commercial vessel flying the American flag that rammed a Canadian Coast Guard cutter. All we know from the Canadians is that the vessel was a small container ship carrying the name Atlanta. The Canadians thought they would nab her farther into the passage, near Somerset Island, but the ship never materialized. They believe she may have sunk, but our analysts believe it is possible she could have backtracked to the Atlantic without being seen. The marine registries show a dozen ships named Atlanta, although only one is of comparable size and configuration. It is sitting in a dry dock in Mobile, Alabama, where it has been parked for the last 3 weeks.
Perhaps the Canadians were right, and she sank from her own damage caused by the ramming incident, the president said. Otherwise, we have to assume a case of mistaken identity. Odd that they would aim to run the passage and then disappear, Sandecker noted. What about the Beaufort Sea ice camp? I've been told that we had no vessels anywhere near the area.
That is correct, Moss replied. All three of the ice camp survivors claim they saw a gray warship flying American colors burst through the camp. One of the men identified the ships carrying the number 54. As it happens, FFG 54 is currently on station in the Beaufort Sea.
One of our frigates?
Yes, the Ford, out of Everett, Washington. She was supporting a submarine exercise off Point Barrow at the time of the incident, but that was over 300 miles away. Aside from that, the Ford is not ice-rated, so she would have had no business plowing through the thick sea ice that supported the camp.
Another case of mistaken identity? The president asked.
Nobody knows for sure. There's just not much in the way of traffic in that area, and there was a heavy storm at the time that obscured things.
What about satellite imagery? Sandecker asked.
Moss flipped through a folder, then pulled out a report. Satellite coverage in that region is pretty sporadic, for obvious reasons. Unfortunately, we didn't have any imagery available within 12 hours of the incident.
Do we know for sure it wasn't the Ford? Could they have made a mistake? The president probed.
No, sir, the Secretary of Defense replied. I had Pacific Command review their navigation records. The Ford never traveled anywhere near the position of the ice camp.
And we've shared that information with the Canadians?
The Chief of the Defense Staff has seen the data and concurs off the record that the Ford was likely not responsible, replied the Secretary of Defense. But the politicians don't trust what we are giving them, quite frankly. Given the mileage they have made out of the incident, they have no reason to backtrack now.
Find those ships and we find our way out of this mess, the president stated. His advisors fell silent, knowing that the window of opportunity had likely already passed. Without direct access to the Canadian Arctic, there was little they could even hope to do.
We'll do what we can, the Secretary of Defense promised.
The Chief of Staff noted the time, then ushered everyone out of the Oval Office in preparation for the president's next meeting. After the others had left the room, Ward stood at the window and gazed out at the Rose Garden.
War with Canada, he muttered to himself. Now there's a real legacy.
Chapter 32 Mitchell Goyette peered out the glass-walled office on the top deck of his yacht and idly watched a silver seaplane taxiing across the harbor. The small plane quickly hopped off the water and circled south, bypassing the tall buildings lining Vancouver Harbor. The magnate took a sip from a martini glass, then turned his gaze to a thick contract sitting on the desk. "The terms and conditions are acceptable," he asked. A small man with black hair and thick glasses seated opposite Goyette nodded his head. "The legal department has reviewed it and found no issues with the changes. The Chinese were quite pleased with the initial test shipment and are anxious to receive an ongoing supply stream.
With no change in price or limits on quantity?
No, sir. They agreed to accept up to 5 million tons a year of unrefined Athabasca crude bitumen and all the Melville Sound natural gas we can deliver, both at prices 10% above the spot market, providing we agree to extended terms. Goyette leaned back in his chair and smiled.
Our ocean-going barges have proven their worth at transporting both cargoes in bulk. We've got our fifth string of LNG barges coming online next week. The potential revenue stream from the Chinese is shaping up quite nicely.
The gas strike at Melville Sound promises to be quite a windfall. Our projections show a net profit of nearly $5 million is possible with each shipment to China, providing the government doesn't initiate restrictions on natural resource sales to China. You are well positioned to capitalize on their growing appetite for energy.
The unfortunate death of MP Finlay seems to have quelled all that, Goyette replied with a knowing grin.
With the reduction of Athabasca refining due to the restrictive carbon dioxide mandate, the Chinese deal is lucrative for your Alberta holdings as well. You will, of course, be defaulting on the agreements just signed with the Americans to provide them the Melville natural gas.
The Chinese are paying me 10% more.
The president was relying on an influx of natural gas to halt their energy crisis, the attorney said in a cautionary tone.
Yes, and they've called on me and my Melville Sound reserves to save them, Goyette said with a laugh. Only we're going to turn up the heat a bit.
A fire suddenly burned in his eyes.
Let them stew in their own juices until they reach a state of true desperation. Then they'll play it my way and pay my prices in order to survive. We'll have our tankers carry gas to them and haul away their liquid carbon wastes on the return trip, and we'll charge a premium for both. Of course, that will be after they finance a major expansion of our barge fleet. They'll have no choice but to accept.
A grin slowly crossed his lips.
I still worry about the political trouble. There's talk of anti-American legislation that could spill over and impact our business with China. Some of the more rabid members of Parliament are practically ready to declare war.
I can't control the idiocy of politicians. The important point was to remove the Americans from the Arctic while we expand our acquisition of gas, oil, and mineral rights. We happened to get lucky with the Melville strike, but the strategy is clearly working quite nicely so far.
The geophysics team is close to identifying the necessary tracts to encompass the Melville gas field, as well as some other promising locations. I just hope that the Natural Resources Minister continues to accommodate our requirements.
Don't you worry about Minister Jameson. He will do anything I ask. By the way, what is the latest from the Alberta?
She arrived in New York without incident, took on a commercial shipment, and is presently eastbound to India. There appear to be no suspicions raised.
Good. Have her sent on to Indonesia for a repaint in new colors before she returns to Vancouver.
It will be done. The attorney replied. Goyette sat back in his chair and took a sip of his drink.
Have you seen Marcy about?
One of a handful of ex-strippers Goyette kept on the payroll, Marcy usually wandered the boat in revealing attire. The aide shook his head firmly, taking the cue that it was time to leave.
I'll inform the Chinese that we have a deal, he said, taking the signed contract from Goyette and quickly exiting the office.
Goyette drained his glass, then reached for a shipboard phone to call the master stateroom, when a familiar voice froze his movements.
Another drink, Mitchell?
Goyette turned to the far side of the office, where Clay Zack stood with a couple of martinis in one hand. He was dressed in dark slacks and a taupe turtleneck sweater, nearly blending in with the room's earth-toned walls. Casually walking closer, he set one glass down in front of Goyette, then took a seat opposite him.
Mitchell Goyette, King of the Arctic, eh? I must say I have seen photographs of your ocean-going barges and am quite awed. A stirring display of naval architecture.
They were specifically designed for the task, Goyette said, finally finding his voice. A look of annoyance remained etched in his face, and he made a mental note to have a word with his security detail.
Fully loaded, they can sail through a Category 2 hurricane without risk.
Impressive,
Zack replied, between sips of his martini.
Though I suspect your environmental worshippers would be disappointed to know that you are raping the country's pristine landscape of natural resources strictly to make a buck off the Chinese.
I didn't expect to see you back so soon, Goyette replied, ignoring the remark. Your project to the States was accomplished with success.
Indeed.
You were correct in taking an interest in the lab's work. I had a remarkable conversation about artificial photosynthesis with your research mole.
Zack proceeded to describe the details of Lisa Lane's work and her recent discovery.
Goyette felt his anger at Zack diminish as the magnitude of Lane's scientific breakthrough sank in. He peered out the window once more.
Sounds like they could build an industrial carbon dioxide conversion facility that could be easily replicated, he said. Still, they've got to be talking years or decades in the future.
Zack shook his head.
I'm no scientist, but according to your boy on the inside, that is not the case. He claims the actual working process requires little in the way of capital resources. He suggested that within 5 years, you might have hundreds of these facilities built around major cities and key industrial emission sites.
But you put an end to such possibilities? Goyette asked, his eyes boring into Zack. The assassin smiled.
No bodies, remember?
The lab and all their research materials are history, as you requested. But the chief researcher is still alive, and she knows the formula. I'd venture there's a good chance plenty more people know the recipe by now.
Goyette stared at Zack without blinking, wondering if it had been a mistake to rein in the assassin this one time.
Your own mole is probably off selling the results to a competitor as we speak, Zack continued.
He won't live long if he does, Goyette replied. His nostrils flared as he shook his head.
This could kill my carbon sequestration plant expansion. Worse still, it would permit the Athabasca refineries to come back online, even expand.
That'd drive down the price of Athabasca bitumen. It'd ruin my contract with the Chinese.
I won't have it.
Zack laughed at Goyette's greed-induced anger, which drove the mogul to more fury. Reaching into his pocket, he pulled out a small gray pebble and bounced it across the desk. Goyette instinctively caught it against his chest.
Mitchell, 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 you are missing the big picture. Where's the grand environmentalist, the king of green, the tree-hugger's best friend?
What are you babbling about? Goyette sneered.
You're holding it in your hand. A mineral called ruthenium, otherwise known as the catalyst to artificial photosynthesis. It is the key to the whole thing.
Goyette studied the stone with quiet regard.
Go on. He replied curtly. It is rarer than gold. There are only a few places on Earth where the stuff has ever been mined, and every one of those mines has gone kaput. This sample came from a geology warehouse in Ontario, and they might well be the last source of the stuff. Without ruthenium, there can be no artificial photosynthesis, and your problem is solved. I'm not saying it can be done, but whoever owns the supply of the mineral will own the solution to global warming. Think how your green friends would worship you then.
It was the perfect tonic of greed and power that made Goyette tick. Zack could almost see the dollar signs light up in his eyes as he digested the possibilities.
Yes, Goyette nodded hungrily.
Yes, we'll have to explore the market. I'll get some people on it at once. Staring back at Zack, he asked, You seem to have a bit of the bloodhound in you. How would you like to visit this warehouse in Ontario and find out where this ruthenium came from and how much of a supply is left?
Providing Terra Green Air is operating a scheduled flight, Zack replied with a smile.
You can use the jet, Goyette grumbled.
But there's another matter of minor importance that requires your attention beforehand. It seems I have a small annoyance in Kitimat.
Kitimat? Isn't that near Prince Rupert?
Goyette nodded and handed Zack the facts he had received from the Natural Resources Minister. Reading the document, Zack nodded, then gulped down his martini.
I'll take care of it on the way to Ontario, he said, stuffing the facts into a pocket and rising from the chair.
He moved toward the door, then turned back toward Goyette.
You know, that research mole of yours, Bob Hamilton? You might consider posting him a nice bonus for the information he provided. Might make you a bit of money down the road.
I suppose, Goyette grunted, then he closed his eyes and grimaced.
Just knock next time, will you please, he said.
But when he opened his eyes, Zack was already gone. Chapter 33 The true diehard members of the Potomac Yacht Club had already capitalized on the sparkling Sunday morning weather and taken to the river in their sailboats by the time Pitt stepped onto the main dock at 9 o'clock. An overweight man toting an empty gas can trudged toward Pitt, sweating profusely in the muggy morning air.
"Excuse me," Pitt asked. "Can you tell me where the Roberta Ann is berthed?"
The fat man's face brightened at the name.
"That's Dan Martin's boat. He's on the far dock, the third or fourth berth down. Tell him Tony wants his electric drill back."
Pitt thanked the man and made his way to the last dock, quickly spotting the Roberta Ann as he stepped down a ramp from the quay. She was a gleaming wood sailboat of just under 40 feet. Built in Hong Kong in the 1940s, she was all varnished teak and mahogany, accented by loads of brass fittings that sparkled in the sunlight. In impeccable condition, she was a boat that oozed the romance of another era. Admiring the sleek lines, Pitt could practically envision Clark Gable and Carol Lombard sailing her under the stars to Catalina with a case of bootleg champagne aboard. The image was shattered by a string of four-letter words that suddenly wafted from the stern. Pitt walked closer, to find a man hunched down in a bay that housed the sailboat's small inboard motor.
"Permission to come aboard?" Pitt called out.
The man popped upright, a frustrated snarl on his face, softening at the sight of Pitt.
"Dirk Pitt, what a pleasant surprise. Come to mock my seafaring ways?"
"On the contrary. You have the Roberta Ann looking shipshape and Bristol fashion," Pitt said, stepping aboard and shaking hands with Dan Martin. A tough Bostonian with thick brown hair, Martin gazed at Pitt through a pair of elfin blue eyes that seemed to dance with mirth.
"Trying to get her prepped for the President's Cup regatta next weekend, but the inboard motor has given me fits. New carburetor, wiring, and fuel pump, yet she still doesn't want to fire up."
Pitt leaned over the hatch and studied the four-cylinder engine.
"That looks like the motor from an old American Austin," he said, recalling a minuscule car built in the 20s and 30s.
"Good guess. It's actually an American Bantam motor. The second owner had an American Bantam dealership and apparently tore out the original engine and inserted the Bantam. She ran fine until I decided to overhaul her."
"Always the case."
"Can I get you a beer?" Martin offered, rubbing his oil-stained hands on a rag.
"A little early for me," Pitt replied, shaking his head.
Martin kicked open a nearby ice chest and rummaged around until locating a bottle of Sam Adams. Popping the cap, he leaned on a rail and inhaled a large swig.
"I take it you didn't come down here strictly to talk boats," he said.
"No, that's simply a bonus," Pitt said with a grin.
"Actually, Dan, I was wondering what you know about the explosion at the George Washington University Research Lab last week."
"Since the director of NUMA isn't calling at my office, I presume this is an unofficial inquiry?"
"Entirely off the record," Pitt replied with a nod.
"What's your interest?"
Martin turned his gaze to the beer bottle, studying its label.
"Lisa Lane, the scientist whose lab exploded, is a close friend of my wife's. I had just walked into the building to give her a report when the place detonated."
"Amazing nobody was killed," Martin replied.
"But it does appear to have been a measured blast."
"You have people working on it?"
Martin nodded. When the D.C. police couldn't identify a cause, they flagged it as a potential terrorist act and called us in. We sent 3 agents over a few days ago. Dan Martin was the director of the FBI's Domestic Terrorism Operations Unit within the agency's Counterterrorism Division. Like Pitt, Martin had an affinity for old cars as well as boats, and had become friends with the Numa director after competing against him at a vintage auto concours some years earlier.
So nobody believes the explosion was an accident, Pitt asked.
We can't say definitively just yet, but things are looking in that direction. A ruptured gas line was the first thing police investigators looked at, but the epicenter of the explosion was well away from the nearest gas line. The building's gas line didn't, in fact, rupture from the explosion, which might have caused much more damage.
That would seem to suggest the source was a planted device, if not something in the lab itself.
Martin nodded. I've been told that there were canisters of oxygen and carbon dioxide in there, so that's one suspicion. But my agents have performed a full residue sampling test, so that ought to tell us if there was any foreign material involved that can't be placed in the lab. I'm expecting the results on my desk tomorrow. Miss Lane didn't seem to believe it was caused by anything that she brought into the lab. Are you familiar with her area of research?
Some sort of biochemistry related to greenhouse gases is what I was told.
Pitt explained Lisa's attempt to create artificial photosynthesis and her breakthrough discovery right before the explosion.
You think there might be a connection with her research work?
Martin asked, draining his beer and tossing the empty back into the cooler.
I have no evidence, just a suspicion. You'll know as much when you determine if there was a planted explosive.
Any likely culprits? Pitt shook his head. Lane had no conceivable suspects when I asked her directly.
If we rule out an accidental explosion, then we'll start the background investigations and see if there were any personal motivations lurking about. But I'll add potential industrial sabotage to the list. There might be some outstanding lawsuits against GWU that will give us a direction to look.
There's one other avenue you might examine. Lane's assistant, a fella named Bob Hamilton. Again, I've got no evidence, but something struck me as odd regarding his absence from the area when the lab went up. Martin looked at Pitt, reading a disquieting sign in his eyes. He knew Pitt well enough to realize he wasn't engaging in baseless hunches or abject paranoia. If Pitt had an instinct, it was probably as good as money in the bank.
I'll have him checked out, Martin promised. Anything else on your mind?
Pitt nodded with a sly smile. A case of misalignment, he said, then climbed into the small engine bay. He reached over the engine and unclipped a high-mounted distributor cap. Rotating it 180 degrees, he set it back on the distributor housing and replaced the clip.
Try her now, he told Martin.
The FBI man stepped over to the sailboat's cockpit and hit the starter button. The little engine turned over twice, then fired to life, idling like a sewing machine on steroids. Martin let the engine warm up for a few minutes, then shut it off, a look of embarrassment on his face.
By the way, Tony is looking for his drill, Pitt said, rising to leave.
Martin smiled.
Good of you to stop by, Dirk. I'll let you know what we come up with on the lab.
I'd appreciate it. Good luck in the regatta. As Pitt climbed onto the dock, Martin remembered something and yelled over.
I heard you finished the restoration on your Auburn and have been seen racing around town in her. I'd love to see her run.
Pitt shook his head with a pained look.
A nasty rumor, I'm afraid, he said, then turned and walked away.
Chapter 34
The forensic analysis of residue material found in the GWU lab reached Martin's desk at 10 the next morning. After consulting with the lead investigative agent, Martin picked up the phone and called Pitt.
Dirk, I've got our first look at the lab's site residue analysis. Afraid I can't release a copy of the report to you, however.
I understand, Pitt replied. Can you give me the 30,000-foot view of the findings?
You were right on the money.
Our lab analysts are nearly certain it was a planted explosive. They found trace samples of nitroglycerin all over the room.
Isn't that the explosive element of dynamite?
Yes, that's how it's packaged, in the familiar dynamite sticks. Not high-tech, but it is a powerful explosive that carries a wicked punch.
I didn't realize they still made the stuff.
It's been around for years, but there's still a heavy industrial demand for it, primarily in underground mining.
Any chance of tracing its origin?
There are only a handful of manufacturers, and each uses a slightly different formula, so there is, in fact, an identifying signature in the compound. The lab has already matched the samples up with an explosives manufacturer in Canada.
That narrows things down a bit.
True, but chances are it will be the end of the line. We'll send some agents up to talk to the company and check their sales records, but I wouldn't be too hopeful. The odds are that the explosives were stolen from a mining customer who doesn't even know the stuff is missing. I just hope this isn't the start of some serial bombing campaign.
I'd bet against it, Pitt said. I think it was specifically targeted against Lane's research.
You're probably right. There was an additional finding that would support that theory. Our bomb analysts determined that the explosives were packed in a cardboard container. Unlike a pipe bomb, where the shrapnel from the pipe is intended to maim or kill, our bomber used a relatively benign approach. It does appear as if the explosion wasn't meant to kill, or certainly kill in numbers.
A saving grace, Pitt replied, but I take it your work is just beginning.
Yes, the test results will blow the investigation wide open.
We'll be talking to everyone in the building. That will be our next hope, that someone saw something or somebody out of place that will give us our next lead. Martin knew that random explosions were one of the worst crimes to investigate and often the most difficult to solve.
Thanks for the update, Dan, and good luck. If anything comes to me, I'll let you know.
Pitt hung up and walked down the hall to a briefing on NUMA's hurricane warning buoys in the Gulf of Mexico. He then cleared his afternoon calendar and made his way out of the headquarters building. The explosion at the GWU lab gnawed at his consciousness, and try as he might, he couldn't shake the feeling that there were serious consequences at play. He drove to the Georgetown University Hospital, hoping that Lisa had not yet been released. She was still in her room on the second floor, along with a squat man in a three-piece suit. The man rose from a corner chair and glared at Pitt as he entered.
"It's all right, Agent Bishop," Lisa said from her bed. "This is Dirk Pitt, a friend of mine."
The FBI agent nodded without emotion, then left the room to stand in the hallway.
"Do you believe that?" Lisa said, greeting Pitt. "The FBI has been questioning me all day, and now they won't leave me alone."
"They must have a soft spot for pretty research biochemists," Pitt replied with a warm grin. He was secretly thankful for the guard, knowing that Martin was taking the matter seriously. Lane blushed at the comment.
"Lauren phoned a short time ago, but didn't mention that you would be coming by."
"I became a little concerned after hearing of the FBI's investigation," he said. He noted that Lisa looked vastly improved since his last visit. Her color had returned, her eyes were clear, and her voice was strong. But a leg cast and a shoulder sling indicated that she was still far removed from participating in a game of Twister.
"What's going on?"
"They haven't told me anything," she said, giving him a pleading look.
"They think it may have been a planted bomb that blew up."
"I figured that's what they were driving at," she said in a whisper. "I just can't believe that would be true."
"They apparently found residue of an explosive material in your lab. I know that it is hard to figure. Do you have any enemies, personal or professional, that might have a grudge?"
"I went all through that with the FBI agents this morning," she said, shaking her head. "There's not a soul I know who could even conceive of doing such an act. And I know the same goes for Bob."
"It's possible the explosives were placed in your lab at random, perhaps by some crazy who had a beef with the university."
"That is the only rationale I can think of. Though Bob and I always lock the lab when nobody's there."
"There is another possibility," Pitt offered. Do you think a competitor might be threatened by the results of your research? Lisa contemplated the question for a moment.
I suppose it is possible.
I've published papers related to my general research, and there are far-reaching effects. But the fact is, only you, Lauren, and Bob were aware of my catalyst breakthrough. Nobody else even knew. It seems hard to believe someone could react so quickly, if they were indeed aware of the discovery.
Pitt remained silent as Lisa looked out the window for a moment.
It seems to me that a working means of artificial photosynthesis would have only a positive benefit. I mean, who could possibly be hurt by a reduction in greenhouse gases?
Answer that, and we have a potential suspect, Pitt said. He eyed a wheelchair parked along the opposite side of the bed. When are they going to cut you loose from here?
The doctor said tomorrow afternoon, most likely. Not soon enough for me. I'd like to get back to work and write up my findings.
You can resurrect the test results? Pitt asked.
Conceptually, it's all still up here, she said, tapping a finger to her head. I'll have to borrow a bit of lab equipment to redocument things, however. That's providing the Ontario Miners Co-op can come up with another sample of ruthenium.
Your source of the mineral?
Yes. It's very costly. The stuff may end up being my downfall.
You should be able to obtain more grant money now, I would think.
It's not just the cost of the ruthenium. It's the actual availability. Bob says it is almost impossible to find.
Pitt thought a moment, then smiled at Lisa. Don't worry. Things will work out. I better not interrupt your convalescence anymore. If you need someone to push your wheelchair, don't hesitate to call.
Thanks, Dirk. You and Lauren have been too kind. As soon as I'm mobile, you two are invited for dinner.
I can't wait. Pitt made his way back to his car, noting the time was nearly 5:30. Following a hunch, he called Lauren and told her he would be late, then drove back to the Numa building. Riding the elevator to the 10th floor, he exited into the heart of the agency's computer operations. An imposing array of the latest information processors and storage devices held an unequaled repository of data on the world's oceans. Up to the second current, tide, and weather conditions from satellite-fed sea buoys gave an instant snapshot of every major body of water around the globe. The computer system also housed a mountain of oceanographic research materials, allowing instant access to the latest findings in marine science. Pitt found a man in a ponytail seated at a large console, arguing with an attractive woman standing a few feet in front of him. Hiram Yeager was the architect of the Numa Computer Center and an expert in database management. Though dressed eclectically in a tie-dyed T-shirt and cowboy boots, Yeager was a devoted family man who doted on his two teenage daughters. Pitt knew Yeager always made breakfast for his wife and daughters, and often sneaked away to soccer games and concert recitals in the afternoon, making up the lost time during the evening hours. As Pitt walked near, he marveled, as he always did, that the woman arguing with Yeager was not real, but rather a hologram that looked remarkably three-dimensional. Designed by Yeager himself as a computer interface to the vast network system, the holographic woman was modeled after his wife and affectionately named Max.
"Mr. Pitt, can you please straighten out Hiram?" Max said, turning toward Pitt. "He doesn't want to believe me when I tell him a woman's handbag should match her shoes."
"I always trust what you have to say," Pitt replied with a nod.
"Thank you. There you have it," she turned, lecturing Yeager.
"Fine, fine," Yeager replied, throwing up his hands. "Some help you are in picking out a birthday present for my wife."
Yeager turned toward Pitt.
"I should never have programmed her to argue like my wife," he said, shaking his head.
Pitt took a seat next to him.
"He wanted her to be as lifelike as possible," he countered with a laugh.
"Tell me you have something to talk about besides ladies' fashions," he pleaded. "As a matter of fact, I'd like Max to help me with a few mineralogy questions."
"A welcome change of topics," Max replied, peering down her nose at Yeager. "I'm delighted to help you, Director.
What is it that you would like to know?
For starters, what can you tell me about the mineral ruthenium? Max closed her eyes for a second, then spoke rapidly.
Ruthenium is a transition metal of the platinum group, known for its hardness. Silvery white in color, it is the 44th element, also known by its symbol Ru. The name derives from the Latin word Rus, from which Russia originates. A Russian geologist, Karl Klaus, made its discovery in 1844.
Are there any unique demands or uses of the mineral? Pitt asked.
Its qualities as a hardener, especially when combined with other elements, such as titanium, were highly valued in industry. Supply irregularities have produced a sharp rise in prices recently, forcing manufacturers to turn to other compounds.
How expensive can it be? Asked Jaeger.
It is one of the rarest minerals found on Earth. Recent spot market prices have exceeded $12,000 an ounce.
Wow, Jaeger replied. That's 10 times the price of gold. Wish I owned a ruthenium mine.
Hiram raises a good question, Pitt said. Where is the stuff mined?
Max frowned for a moment as her computer processors sifted through the databases.
The supplies are rather unsettled at the moment. South Africa and the Ural Mountains of Russia have been the historical sources for mined ruthenium in the last century. Approximately 10 metric tons a year was mined in South Africa from a single mine in Bushveld, but their output peaked in the 1970s and fell to nearly zero by 2000. Even with the run-up in price, they've had no new production.
In other words, their mines have played out, Pitt suggested.
Yes, that is correct. There have been no significant discoveries made in the region in over 40 years.
That still leaves the Russians, Jaeger said.
Max shook her head. The Russian ruthenium came from just 2 small mines adjacent to one another in the Vissim Valley. Their production had actually peaked back in the 1950s. A severe landslide destroyed and buried both mining operations several years ago. The Russians have abandoned both sites, stating it would take many years to return either mine to operation.
No wonder the price is so steep, Jaeger said. What's your interest in the mineral, Dirk?
Pitt described Lisa Lane's artificial photosynthesis discovery and the role of ruthenium as a catalyst, along with the explosion in the lab. Jaeger let out a low whistle after digesting the implications.
That's going to make an unsuspecting mine owner a rich man, he said.
Only if the stuff can be found, Pitt replied. Which makes me wonder, Max, where would I go to purchase a bulk quantity of ruthenium?
Max looked up toward the ceiling.
Let's see. There are 1 or 2 Wall Street precious commodities brokers that would be able to sell you some for investment purposes, but the quantities available are quite small. I'm only finding a small platinum mine in South America that has trace byproduct quantities for sale, which would require further processing. The present known stocks of the mineral appear to be quite meager. The only other publicized source is the Ontario Miners Co-op, which lists a limited quantity of high-grade ruthenium available by the troy ounce.
The co-op is where Lisa obtained her sample, Pitt stated. What more can you tell me about it?
The Miners Co-op represents independently owned mines across Canada, acting as wholesale outlet for mined ore. Their headquarters is in the town of Blind River, Ontario.
Thank you, Max. You've been a great help as always, Pitt said.
He had long ago transcended his uneasiness at speaking to the computerized image and, like Jaeger, almost felt like Max was a real person.
A pleasure any time, Max replied with a nod. Turning to Jaeger, she admonished, Now don't you forget about my advice for your wife.
Goodbye, Max, Jaeger replied, tapping at a keyboard. In an instant, Max disappeared from view. Jaeger turned to Pitt.
A shame your friend's discovery may be for naught if there's no ruthenium around to power the process.
As important as the ramifications are, a source will be found, Pitt said confidently.
If your hunch about the lab explosion is correct, then somebody else already knows about the scarcity of the mineral.
Pitt nodded. My fear as well. If they are willing to kill to halt the research, then they are probably willing to try and monopolize the remaining supplies.
So where do you go from here?
There's only one place to go, he said. The Ontario Miners Co-op, to see how much ruthenium really is left on the planet.
Part 2. Black Kabluna. Chapter 35. Summer was waiting at the dock when she spotted Trevor's boat motoring across the harbor. She wore a tight-fitting saffron-colored sweater, which accentuated the radiant red hair that dangled loose beneath her shoulders. Her gray eyes softened as the boat approached the dock, and Trevor leaned out the wheelhouse and waved. "Going my way, sailor?" she asked with a grin. "If I wasn't before, I am now," he replied with an approving look. He reached up and gave Summer a hand as she climbed onto the boat. "Where's Dirk?" he asked. His head was still pounding this morning, so he took some aspirin and went back to bed. Trevor shoved the boat away from the pier and motored past the municipal dock before turning into the harbor. Had he glanced at the dock's small dirt parking lot, he might have noticed a sharp-dressed man sitting in a brown jeep observing their departure.
"Did you finish your inspection this morning?" Summer asked as they cruised past a heavily loaded lumber ship.
"Yes. The aluminum smelter is just looking at a minor expansion of their receiving yard. Mandatory environmental impact statement sort of stuff."
He looked at Summer with a twisted grin.
"I was relieved not to find the police waiting for me at the boat this morning."
"I doubt anybody saw you at the Terra Green facility.
It's Dirk and me who are most likely to end up on a wanted poster at the Kitimat post office," she replied with an uneasy laugh.
"I'm sure the plant security is not going to file a report with the police. After all, as far as they know, they're responsible for Dirk's murder."
"Unless a surveillance camera caught you fishing him out alive."
"In which case, we're all in a bit of trouble." He turned and gave Summer a concerned look. "Maybe it would be a good idea if you and Dirk kept a low profile around town. A tall, gorgeous redhead tends to stand out in Kitimat."
Rather than blush, Summer moved closer to Trevor and looked deep into his eyes. He let go of the boat's wheel and slipped his arms around her waist, drawing her tight. Returning her gaze, he kissed her once, long and passionately.
"I don't want anything to happen to you," he whispered.
The pilot of a small freighter passing the other way happened to witness the embrace and blew his horn at the two. Trevor casually released one hand and waved at the freighter, then retook the wheel. Sailing briskly down Douglas Channel, he kept his other arm locked tightly around Summer's thin waist. The turquoise Numa boat was moored as they had left it, and Summer quickly had the vessel underway. The two boats playfully raced each other back to Kitimat, passing far around the Terra Green facility without incident. They had just tied up at the municipal pier when Dirk came rambling down the dock. His gait was slow, and he wore a baseball cap to cover the bandage across his skull.
"How's the head?" Trevor inquired.
"Better," Dirk replied. "The pounding has gone down from dynamite to sledgehammer strength. The bells of St. Mary's are still ringing loud and clear, though."
Summer finished tying up the Numa boat and walked over to the two men with a thick case in her hand.
"You ready to get to work?" she asked.
"The water samples," Trevor said.
"Yes, the water samples," she replied, holding up the Kitimat Municipal Pool water analyzing kit.
She stepped onto Trevor's boat and helped gather up the water samples taken the night before. Dirk and Trevor took a seat on the gunwale as Summer opened the test kit and began checking the acidity of the water samples.
"I'm showing a pH of 8.1, she said after testing the first sample. "The acidity is just a hair above the levels in the surrounding waters, but not significant."
She proceeded to test all of her water samples and then the vials collected by Trevor. The results were nearly uniform for each vial tested. As she checked the results of the last sample, a defeated look crossed her face.
"Again, the pH level is reading about 8.1.
Remarkably, the water around the Terra Green facility shows no abnormal levels of acidity."
"That seems to blow our theory that the plant is dumping carbon dioxide," Trevor said.
"A gold star for Mitchell Goyette," Dirk said sarcastically.
I can't help but wonder about the tanker ship, Summer said.
Trevor gave her a quizzical look.
We got sidetracked and couldn't prove it, but Dirk and I both thought the tanker might be taking on CO2 rather than unloading it.
Doesn't make much sense, unless they're transporting it to another sequestration facility, or are dumping it at sea.
Before trailing a tanker halfway around the world, I think we need to take another look at the site where we measured the extreme water acidity, Summer said. And that's Hecate Strait.